For reporters and political junkies alike, this is a very exciting time of the year because election season has officially kicked off. All of the candidates who are running for state assembly, state senate, governor, and Congress have been verified and are now on the ballots both for the August primary and for the November general election. This hour, we'll bring on one of our resident political science experts to discuss the races, who's running, and what we might expect during the summer and fall campaign season. This is The West Side. And now joining me in studio is one of our favorite guests. We've got Emeritus Political Science Professor at UW-Eau Claire, Mort Cypress. Mort, thanks for joining us this morning.
Glad to be here.
We're talking about politics, folks, regionally and statewide. You can call in. You can take part of this discussion by calling us at 800-228-5615. Do you know who is running for state office in your region? If not, give us a call. If you've got a question or a comment about other things, political, give us a call as well. 800-228-5615. So, Mort, you and I have been in the studio a few times together talking about the results of an election or something like that. We see again in this election cycle that it seems like the Democratic Party is running someone in almost every single state, Senate and Assembly seat held by Republicans, at least in our region. That's about 14 races, many of which are pretty safe Republican districts. What do you make of that?
It's part of the strategy of both parties. The Democrats have candidates in virtually every district, not only in the region but around the state, in order to try to prevent Republicans from concentrating their resources on just a few districts. The Republicans, on the other hand, don't want to spend resources in those areas where they know they're not going to win. And we have a couple of those districts in our area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, fewer, though, I would say, on the Republican side, because in 2012, I thought I remember hearing there was something like 15 races statewide that weren't contested. In our region, I can only think of Dana Walks here in Eau Claire, 93rd Assembly District.
Also the 92nd Assembly District.
Oh, which that's Chris Dano, isn't it?
Yes.
Oh, I thought he was, I thought he had a challenger.
At least in the in the Government Accountability Board listings, he is not. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, we got Isaac
Wicks.
I'm
sorry. I got myself confused with someone else. Isaac Wicks is running against Dano in that district. So you're right. It is just the one district, the 91st district.
But since we're on the 92nd, let's talk about that. Isaac Wicks is a familiar candidate for a lot of people in western Wisconsin when Sheila Harsdorf was being recalled in the state Senate district based in River Falls. She had a challenger, Shelley Moore, who was a school teacher, Democrat from Ellsworth. Then Isaac Wicks, who's a pretty well-known Republican, ran as a Democrat, and it caused a lot of ire.
Yes, and you'll notice that in this year's election, he's running as a Republican.
Right. Do you think candidates or voters will take Wicks seriously? Do you think he'll mount a serious challenge to Chris Dano, who's pretty entrenched down there in Trempealeau?
Well, he's become that entrenched. He's been reelected a couple of times, and that gives him more name recognition, better access to funds. He'll be in that district. He'll be a tough one to beat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then Isaac Wicks. The last time he was running, he was based in Ellsworth, and I looked. I didn't look terribly closely at the maps, but it almost looks like Wicks would have had to move because this district no longer goes over to the Ellsworth area. It doesn't seem. I'm not sure about that, but
I would have to check the map, but I think it does.
Okay. Yeah, and then we mentioned Dana Walks. On the flip side, we've got the one seat that's up for grabs, 91st, held by attorney and Democrat Dana Walks. Not going to be challenged by Republicans or Democrats. As I mentioned, last time it seemed that there were more of these seats that were kind of carved out for Democrats during the redistricting process that were being unchallenged. Mm-hmm. But But again, this we've got the one. Do you think Republicans are not taking any chances?
I think that there's two things happening. The Republicans are not putting a lot of resources into candidate recruitment. It doesn't mean they haven't tried somewhat. They're having difficulty recruiting candidates to run in a one-sided district. The Republicans actually created the situation. When they drew the district lines, they drew them in a way so as to minimize competition in assembly districts. For Democrats, they tried to concentrate in their districts as many Democratic voters as they could in order to prevent some of them from having a voice where there's a Republican area. So that was part of the strategy in the reapportionment. And at the same time, they, of course, tried to make sure they had a number of relatively safe Republican districts where they would think Democrats would have a much harder time.
Both parties have used this tool in the past. I mean, we can just look to our South and see Illinois. The Democrats had total control, and they did the same thing there. So it's not specific to one party, but I've heard a lot of people say that the Republicans in Wisconsin were quite effective. The maps that they drew were pretty strong.
This is the first time that there's been available very sophisticated computer programs to help to do that. They can feed in all kinds of data about past voting behavior in specific areas, not just across the state, and that's helped a lot. Previously, we had a system where the courts got involved with it.
Yeah. And well, when the parties couldn't agree.
That's right, yeah. And we went through two censuses in a row where the courts were doing the line drawing rather than either party. And if you go back 20 or 30 years, you didn't have those computer programs that were really available to the political parties. It really has changed now as a result of the 2010 census.
Another thing that changed was it used to be that time was, I guess, local, county, city clerks would draw their lines and then the state would base their lines off of those lines. That, again, was changed in 2011.
They reversed it. The legislature drew its lines first. They were doing it with the help of computerized programs.
Absolutely.
They hired a firm that could use those programs in order to maximize their effectiveness in the legislature.
Redistricting goes high tech, I guess. Say more. We've got a phone call from Willem in Colfax. Willem, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Oh, yeah, about that redistricting. I think that's this sort of extreme political redistricting has a really adverse effect on our democracy, and I think that the way that Iowa does it and some other states in a nonpartisan way is much better for, the idea of democracy, the very nature of democracy. So I think it's really unfortunate that this has happened in our state. And anyway, the reason that I called was about the rapid expansion of sand mining in our area and our current administration's response to it. The DNR admits that airborne silica is a known carcinogen, but it won't list it as a hazardous substance or regulate it the way that the state of California does. And what really concerns me about this is that the head of the DNR, Kathy Stepp, who has a background in real estate development and no background in natural resources, that the DNR had asked for 10 people to regulate the sand mining industry, over 120 mines currently operating and more permitted. But they got only two, and with Tom Tiffany, who was sort of the front man on a Republican policy all over the country about regulating local control so that people can't you know, either pass ordinances about all sorts of things.
Well, that bill didn't make it through this time, but
I've heard that now the next they tried twice, and the next attempt is going to be to stick it into the budget, in which case it won't have to have a public hearing. So I think these attempts to limit local control are, you know, for obvious reasons, to facilitate the expansion of sand mining in our area without the local people having much to say about it. So
what would you have your local politicians do, the representatives, or what would you like to see them do, representatives
from your
region? I would
like to have them pledge to oppose any attempt to limit local control. Not just say that they're opposed or in favor of local control, but actually make a pledge to say that they will actively work to maintain local control, which is quite different than saying that you support local control.
Well, what about this, Willem? When this latest, maybe Senate Bill 349, I think, was the first attempt, and then it was 6-something.
Yeah.
But one of those two times, there were a number of legislators from Western Wisconsin. Dean Knudsen was one. I think Kathy Bernier was another.
Yep.
Where they sent a letter saying that they didn't approve of this bill because of that very reason you mentioned.
Yeah. But what I think is that there's enough, you know, the assemblies are rigged enough that it's probably doubtful. Well, they will control the assembly and probably the Senate. And then some people, I think, in our area where most of the sand mining is going on, they'll, you know, take a political cover and be opposed to it, but they don't really need their vote. They'll be able to pass this without their vote and give their friends this political cover. So that's what I'm concerned about, because this is a national policy supported by a group called ALEC, which I think everyone, if they don't know about it, should look into it. It's a corporate group. Their whole policies, national policies passed in states all around the country, are trying to do the same thing, trying to limit local control. And I think that the Republican Party will do that no matter what they say.
Thanks for that, Willem. Let's get some feedback from Mort on this. First, I'm interested in what your thoughts are, Mort, on the Ohio process for redistricting. There have been some attempts to push lawmakers in this state. I think some Democrats this past session have offered an idea for a nonpartisan redistricting process. Will it ever happen here in Wisconsin?
It's difficult to get it to happen.
Why is that?
Because you're dependent on the majority in the legislature to approve of a change like that. And if they have to go the route of a constitutional amendment, it's even more difficult. It takes two legislative majorities in two successive sessions, plus a referendum.
But if it went to referendum, do you think it would pass?
Probably, yes. In terms of just what is rational, what is common sense, getting it out of the partisan arena does make sense. But when you're asking the people who benefit from the existing system to change that system and create vulnerabilities for themselves, it becomes much more difficult to get a change.
Sure.
And when you take a look at the reapportionment that's been done and its first results 2 years ago, and the very strong possibility of similar results this year, most of the members of the legislature are not in competitive districts. And so their stand on local control may not get beyond the general platitude.
So are you saying, or do you agree with Willem, that this leads to polarization, the increasingly polarized political arena that we're seeing nationwide, not just in Wisconsin?
Yes, and more significant than using the term polarization, it militates against compromise.
Mm.
One side in control is going to control whatever comes through the legislature.
Now,
and it doesn't matter whether it's a Democratic majority or a Republican majority.
Right. They want that power.
Yeah. Now, if you have split control among the governor, the state senate, and the state assembly, some Democratic, some Republican majority control, then the chambers and or the governor have to negotiate with each other to arrive at an agreement.
But if we have that situation where we've got, say, Republicans in the assembly, Democrats in the governor's, or whether it's in the governor's seat or in the state senate, is that the kind of environment where a redistricting bill might be able to slip through if the stars align?
I think it would be very difficult.
Even then?
Because each party has benefited from the existing system.
Okay.
That's how they got into the majority in that chamber.
Right, right. What about sand mining? How big of a role do you think that plays in the elections in western Wisconsin, the state offices? Because we've seen some local races. I've actually followed some town board kind of things, and there have been some people being voted out because of their stance on allowing it.
Mm-hmm. If you have, in legislative districts, to point out first, a larger than, say, a county board district.
Right, right.
And so you get a greater mix of interests in each legislative district. That makes it a little more difficult to resolve the issue without there being compromise. And then where sand mining is a strong presence are the areas where it might make a difference. But if you have areas that are not experiencing sand mining or processing of the sand, and even transportation of it, in those areas where there's no presence, it's not likely to be as controversial.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about election or campaign season, which is starting up right now as we speak in western Wisconsin. We've got Emeritus Political Science Professor Mort Cypress of UW-Eau Claire on the program today. You can call in with your questions and your comments at 800-228-5615. We can let you know and do our best to let you know who's running for state assembly or state senate in your region if you're not sure. Give us a call, 800-228-5615. Let's talk about some races. And I'm going to just kind of skip around, so I'm going to keep you on your toes here, Mort. But to our north, we've got a state senate seat that's been filled for decades. The 25th state senate district was held by Democrat Bob Jouk of Poplar. I grew up in Superior. He was a well-known name up there, maybe not so much down here. But he announced his retirement last session, and in that race, it looks like there will be a Democratic primary. We've got Janet Bewley, who is a state assemblywoman from the, I think, over in the Ashland area, and she will be running against a gentleman named Tom Ratzlaff, who was the mayor of Park Falls over the past 20 years. So what do you think about the fact that we've got Democrats vying for that seat, and there's one lone Republican that's going to be running, in that which will face off, you know, against the winner of the primary. Can a Republican win that district?
It's possible.
It's been radically blue though for a long time.
And until 4 years ago.
Yeah.
4 years ago, the same Republican ran against Jouk, mm-hmm. Dane Deutsch. Deutsch got almost 49% of the vote.
Oh, really?
In that election, indicating that there was some kind of change going on in the district.
You had a big old Republican swing, though. I mean, you had a big wave going on that year, though.
Which would explain part of it, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But it also tells you that depending on turnout, you can get that sort of thing happening again in 2014. Republicans are counting on a 2010 type of wave in order to get keep control of the state Senate.
Mm-hmm.
That makes it possible if voters are just yawning at the general election for the legislature, it gives the well-organized party a greater opportunity. Now, other Democrats lost in 2010 as well in the state Senate. And Russell Decker, for example, in the Warsaw area,
sure.
Was one of the major defeats for the Democrats, major victories for the Republicans. You get a repetition of 2010 this year, and you can see the Republicans actually increasing their control in the Senate. The Democrats are very aware that that can happen. And they are beating the bushes to try to increase enthusiasm for the election, knowing that in terms of voter turnout, Democrats have a bigger challenge than Republicans do.
And why is that?
Demographically, Democratic voters tend to be somewhat lower income, mm-hmm. Tend to be from other groups that simply don't vote as much as, say, middle income, middle class, and upper class groups do, that's part of the strategy behind the attempts at voter suppression that we see going on.
Which, as far as I know, is the voter ID bill, which some would claim is voter suppression. Some would say it's just common sense. That's still tied up in the courts, I believe, right?
Yes, it is. But it was designed in part to discourage certain kinds of voters. People who live in large cities, for example. Many of them, especially low-income people in large cities, don't have transportation. And therefore, may not have a driver's license. Others may have been born in southern states where getting your birth certificate and getting other records can be very challenging, mm-hmm. and may be very difficult to do. There are many people who, if they voted, might vote Democratic rather than Republican, but don't go to the trouble to get some kind of ID.
Well, that lawsuit, you know, the judge did place an injunction on the law, but the Republicans have talked about, you know, making some tweaks to, and even Governor Walker mentioned possibly calling a special session to get this thing passed. It's obviously very important to them. But, you know, there are things. There's the option of being able to get a free state ID card, and also there's another option for people that can prove that they are indigent or that, you know, might not be able to get a – there are exemptions, they would argue.
Mm-hmm. When you have people having to jump through hoops in order to vote, some just aren't going to bother. And it becomes a way of reducing voter turnout. Now that voter turnout is dramatically high in Wisconsin or in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
The largest voter turnout in a primary was back in 1960. It was about 73% of the voting age population actually voting. Next highest was the election 2 years ago in 2012. We had many years where turnout was down in the 50% and 60% area. Not too much to take home to brag about.
No, that's too low, too low. I want to go back to the 25th again and talk about Dane Deutsch. And I was looking up, trying to find out some information. The name sounded familiar. All I could find were articles referring to a comment that he made, I think, back in 2010, having to do with Hitler. And here's the quote: "Hitler and Lincoln were both strong leaders. Lincoln's character made him a greater leader whose legacy and leadership still lives on." He got in a lot of trouble for that comment, and it made national news. I found the quotation was on Time Magazine's website. That was a long time ago. Do you think that thing can still haunt him?
You can bet it's going to be brought up.
Yeah.
So yes, that sort of thing it may be very difficult. And if you don't have some ability to explain it away, it can be damaging.
Sure. Well, I imagine having 4 years to think about it, you might be able to explain it away a little bit better. We got another caller. Let's take that right away, and then we'll take a quick break and talk more about some of the local races. For listeners, you can call in at 800-228-5615. We're talking about the campaign season that's kicking off right now in western Wisconsin and statewide. The number, 800-228-5615. We got Jim in Chippewa Falls. You're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
What's on your mind?
There's a new pipeline that's running the state of Wisconsin from Duluth Superior, as I understand, the Illinois border and beyond. Now, this pipeline is going to have a greatest impact as I understand it again, as a Keystone pipeline, yet it has hardly any public hearings, if it's had any, and it's kind of flying under the radar. And could you have this brought up by your guest, please?
Sure. Are you familiar, Mort? It would be a tar sands pipeline, I believe, right, Jim?
I'm not sure the particulars.
But Enbridge Energy is looking to run another pipeline having to do with tar sands and or the oil coming from North Dakota. They just don't have the capacity to ship it by rail. Any thoughts, Mort?
How controversial it gets depends on whose backyard it's going to be going through.
Sure.
And the homeowners and the business owners that are most directly affected are the ones likely to complain about it. Otherwise, it's not very visible to most people in terms of the environmental impact and the like. People are more concerned about their immediate cares that they perceive as affecting them. And so it becomes more difficult to get it on the political agenda. If one of the parties decided to make a big issue of it, that could put it on a more visible agenda. And that does not seem to be happening right now.
I haven't heard of it yet, but I bet you it does get brought up during some of the debates that they might have up in the 25th district. Mm-hmm. I bet you it's mentioned.
If I could interrupt just a moment.
Sure, Jim.
One of the reasons it has low visibility is it's had no public hearings, number one. And number two, I think it's going to run the entire length of the state, as I understand. Hmm. That being said, it's going to be partially coming through current pipeline. There will be some new pipeline. And that pipeline is going to double the pressure that's now in the current lines. So the possibility of contamination if there's a rupture of the pipeline in a lot of sensitive areas could be tremendous and not easily accessible either, I might add. So I would just like to bring this up. And if your guest could tell me the name of that pipeline, I just don't recall what it was called.
I think I'm going to have to hop on the computer here while we're discussing. I'll give Mort a question that I know he's going to take some time to answer, and I'll look it up. But, Jim, thanks for the call. Any other thoughts, Mort?
That it might get mentioned at a public hearing, there could be a full fledged public hearing, which is doubtful between now and election time, is not necessarily going to increase the visibility of it to any great extent. If one of the candidates or if several of the candidates decide to keep on repeating things about this pipeline, then you can get more of a public discussion about it. But if candidates don't want to touch it, which at this point seems to be the case, candidates in both parties seem to be reluctant to get into this. As long as that's the case, it does not become a particularly visible problem. You could perhaps generate some attention with grassroots organizing, and sometimes grassroots groups can generate an issue into much higher visibility. But it'll take some organization and some intense activity to get that to happen.
I just hopped online. All I could find was a colleague of mine, Mike Simonson, up in Superior. He's on top of this stuff very well. I'm looking at a $7 billion upgrade to their existing line, Line 3. They're going to have higher pressures. This is the line that's coming from Edmonton, Canada, carries tar sands oil to Superior. So for what it's worth, that's what I found. I'm not seeing anything right off the bat about a pipeline going through the length of the state, but definitely we can keep our eyes out for that.
Yeah, this is the first I've heard of it going through the whole state.
Right. All right, Jim, thanks so much. Let's take our first break here. The number to call in is 800-228-5615. We're talking about politics and campaign season, the elections coming up in western Wisconsin and statewide. This is the West Side. I'm Rich Kramer, and you're listening to The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in this Monday morning. We've got Emeritus Political Science Professor Mort Cyprys from UW-Eau Claire on the program, and we're talking about campaign season kicking off. Candidates are registered. They're on the ballot. And now we just got to wait for those incessant TV commercials to let us know who they are. But in the meantime, we're talking about some of the races in our region. And if you've got any questions about it, give us a call, 800-228-5615. Mort, I want to talk about the 29th State Senate District. It's pretty far to the, I mean, it's just outside of our listening area, which this would be the seat that's currently held by Republican Jerry Petrowski. He got that seat in a recall election in which the incumbent in that election, Pam Galloway, had resigned. Now he's being challenged by a man named Paul DeMaine. He's a Democrat. He's been a spokesperson for the Pinocchio Hills Harvest Camp, the Native American group that is basically camping. They've been camping for about a year in the area where they want to build the iron mine in northern Wisconsin. How likely do you think that iron mine will play into the election? Do you think that's going to be the main issue?
In part of the district, it would be a main issue.
Right, the northern chunk of it.
Yeah, and that can make a difference. Back in 2010, Galloway was elected with 52% of the vote, and it was really a shocker for Democrats. They were assuming that Decker would not have a problem. And obviously, the Republican wave helped in that year. There were some issues that Decker took which rubbed some of the Democrats wrong. Mm. And they may have sat out voting for that particular seat as a result of that. So it became a Republican seat. And then, to everybody's surprise, Galloway dropped out of the seat.
Yeah, she said there was some family medical issues or something.
Yeah, which may be true. Mm-hmm. Or maybe she decided she just doesn't like that kind of campaigning.
Yeah.
Either would be an understandable reason.
Yeah.
But we have no idea. It's a district that reapportionment made a little more Republican, but it still may be pretty competitive. We have no idea whether Petrowski could take advantage of a competitive situation to win, or whether it'll go back in Democratic hands.
Being an incumbent is usually, or I've heard always, kind of a, you know, it's a benefit to you because you've got some name recognition. But mm-hmm. being an incumbent for only a couple years, does that really make that much of a difference?
Depending on whether the incumbent used his time, even if it was just a limited amount of time, used the time to get his name out there.
Sure.
Something most legislative people don't realize is that they may have very, very little name recognition. And what gives them an advantage is as little as they have, it's more than their opponents have.
Yeah.
If you put in enough funding for a challenger, they may be able to make up that difference in name recognition.
Now, what about Paul DeMaine? Like I mentioned, he's been very vocal activist against this mining project. Do you think the fact that he's been quote unquote activist, do you think that might hurt him? His chances of being taken maybe seriously by some independent swing voter types?
It depends on the part of the district you're talking about. Senate Again. Districts, especially in the northern half of the state, are very widespread.
Massive, yeah.
And the further north you go, the more advantageous his activism would be.
Mm-hmm.
Down in Warsaw, which is the largest concentration of voters in that district, it may not have as great an impact.
Now, just keep jumping around. I want to go to the assembly side of things. We've got a really busy race happening in the 87th State Assembly District. That district basically roughly includes Sawyer County, Rusk County, and part of Taylor counties. There, we've had an incumbent, Mary William, a Republican, I think she lives in Medford, has had the seat since 2002. Now we've got four Republicans that will be on the ballot, and it will be in an August primary. A gentleman named Michael Bubb, James Edming. We've got Cheryl LaBarre. We've heard that name before, and Scott, and three Republicans rather, and Scott Noble is the lone Democrat. That's going to be a busy primary. It's a lot of folks trying to get that seat. Any thoughts on that, Mort?
The one that has a modicum of group support and turns out their friends is the one who's likely to win the primary.
That's like it's like I'm in political science 101 here.
It's a situation where the turnout in the Republican primary, in fact, the turnout in the primary across the state could be as high as the mid 20s, or as low as about 8%, enough people have a distaste for politics these days, mm-hmm. That I think the turnout's going to be on the lower end of that. So if we see a turnout of 8, 10, 15% of the registered voters, or rather of the voting age population, someone who could bring to bear a few hundred people from political organization to vote for them may very well win the primary.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that is much more difficult to predict. Nobody didn't do any polls to give us a measure of public opinion.
Right.
The Republican Party will refrain, I believe, from investing heavily until after the primary. So the source of funds is going to be limited. And the interest in the primary is going to be limited. So I don't expect to see a predictable type of pattern there.
Mort, we've got another call on the line from this one from Altoona, and this is Damien on the line. You're on the air, Damien. Thanks for calling.
I really appreciate the show. I'm going back to the Enbridge and the pipeline, and to me that's an incredibly important issue.
Okay.
And it's sad that it's not more on the radar. I happened to get wind of a demonstration in Minneapolis that talked about it and attended hearings over there. And you can go to Wikipedia online, Enbridge, like you mentioned at the beginning of the show, and you can get quite a history. And there's a substantial history that refers to the spills. And there was one in Superior in 2007 with tens of thousands of gallons spilled.
Into the Nemadji River. I was living there at the time.
Do you remember that one?
Yep.
Yep. And then Kalamazoo, Michigan, the river still is not clean. And the cleanup costs were $36 million. And I was fortunate enough to meet people from Kalamazoo, and they had been arrested for protesting the spill and the misinformation coming out and so on. So I just think it would be really worth people taking a little bit of time, going out to Wikipedia, put in Enbridge, and it'll pull up all kinds of interesting information.
So learn about it and then talk to your candidates that are running for office?
Definitely. If the candidates don't put this front and, you know, maybe not front and center. Yeah, it should be front and center as a major issue because, yeah, they have a huge expansion. They're adding substantially to already the longest existing pipeline in the country that they own. And much of it goes through Wisconsin, is going to zigzag back and forth. And with the Kalamazoo River being totally polluted, it used to be a swimming beach and everything, and they spilled all these toxic chemicals in there, and then they put in some pellet to absorb all of the toxins, and they can't get the toxins out. So you go there now, you're still going to run into these pellets that are extremely toxic because they've collected them all. It's just it doesn't make much sense to do things that way.
Gotcha. Damien, thanks for the call. Thanks for the information about the Enbridge company and their expansion plans. The number to call in is 800-228-5615. We can probably take a couple more calls before the end of the hour. We're talking about the campaigns that are ramping up right now in western Wisconsin. We've got a lot of races, 14-some races just in our listening area, and our listening area being basically up near Spooner down to Trempealeau area, and then from the Marshfield area that's all the way over to the Minnesota border. So there's a lot going on legislatively. Mort Cypress, I want to talk about the 93rd Assembly District, which is basically all of Eau Claire County except for the city, and then that district now runs all the way to the west to Prescott through Pepin and Pierce counties. This is this race is getting familiar. It's almost a three-peat. This is Republican incumbent Warren Petrick and Democrat challenger Jeff Smith. This is the third time in a row that they have challenged each other.
That's right. And each time it was a very close election. The last one in 2012, Petrick won with under 51% of the vote. That's extremely competitive. What that tells me is that even circumstances that come out just before the election, you can get something happening which would change the direction of that election. At the same time, it's not an easy district to campaign in. It's really spread out. It takes in a lot of acreage. It makes it difficult to use your resources in an effective way. Do you put your money into media? Do you put your money into direct mail? How much door-to-door campaigning can you do and can your supporters do?
Right.
What kind of effort are you going to make? And you have here two candidates who are very familiar with the area, very familiar with the electorate, I would anticipate another very competitive election. Apparently, if 2012 is any indication, reapportionment didn't radically change the makeup of that district.
Mm-hmm. Let's take our final break here on the west side. We're talking about the campaigns that are in western Wisconsin. The election's coming up. We've got an August primary, and we've got a general election in November, of course. A lot of candidates running for a lot of seats in our region and statewide. We're going to talk about some congressional races coming up, and we're also going to, of course, talk about governor and some of the other statewide kind of issues that surround that. Number to call in, 800-228-5615. I'm joined by Emeritus Political Science Professor Mort Cypress. We'll be back with more West Side right after this. I'm Rich Kramer, and you're listening to the West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm joined by Mort Cypress. He's an Emeritus Political Science Professor at UW-Eau Claire, and he's on the program today. We're talking about the races that are coming up for August and November here in western Wisconsin. Election season is upon us, so watch out, everybody. We just talked about some assembly races, some Senate races, talked about some overall generalities about the reapportionment. I want to talk about Congress now, Mort. Before I go to Congress, one real quick question. We've seen a lot of Republican incumbents statewide announce that they won't be running for reelection. In our region, Mary Williams is one. Scott Severson, I can't think of his first name. He's a doctor, ER doctor in St. Croix Falls. He's not running, but I think there's something like 15, maybe 20 people overall that aren't running. Do you think Democrats are saying that this is our chance? You know, we've got a lot of open seats, but the Republicans say we're going to pick up those seats and we're going to even get more. Any thoughts on whether or not these vacancies could lead to a flip in the assembly? Well, the Republicans are very comfortable with their majority right now.
It'll be very difficult for the Democrats to pick up a majority for there to be that much turnover. I think it's possible for them to pick up a few seats in the assembly. One of the things that vacancies do is open up many, many seats to a little more competition.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives the party that's not been in office there a chance to pick up a seat. But even if the Democrats picked up 5 or 6 seats, it would be far from attaining a majority in the Assembly.
Mm-hmm.
The Senate's another story. In the Senate, there is a real chance of turnover. The Republicans have a 2-seat majority in the Senate. There are some seats which may turn Republican, which have been Democratic up to now. In the Northern District, where Bob Jauch was the senator, is an example of that, mm-hmm. where you could get a switch. But Dale Schultz's seat in the southern part of the state is a possibility for a changeover from Republican to Democratic. Schultz was a fairly moderate Republican.
And he seemed to be punished for that by his party. I think
yes.
he didn't want to run because he expected a more conservative kind of a challenger.
Yeah, and the likelihood then is that the Republican candidate will be someone closer to the Tea Party than to where Schultz stood. So the choice will be between a more moderate Democrat on the one hand and a more ideological candidate on the Republican side. Gives the Democrats a chance to pick up that seat.
And we are getting so close to the top of the hour, and I want to squeeze in a whole bunch of stuff here, Morton. Congress, the 7th District, way up north, we're talking about all the way up from Ashland down into Marathon County. Incumbent Sean Duffy, what I thought was interesting, there's going to be a Democratic and a Republican primary in that race. 2 Republicans are running. What do you make of that? Do you think the party is unhappy with Duffy, or is this just, you know, the good old American government? Anyone can get on the ballot if they get the signatures and pay the fee.
The Republican opposition to Duffy is coming from people who feel he's not conservative enough.
Okay.
So you have people who are more ideological than even Duffy is, and his voting record is fairly conservative in the Congress. And so you get that kind of dissatisfaction. I would be surprised if Duffy lost the primary.
All right, let's keep pushing ahead here. For governor, we've heard all about the 2 front runner candidates. Of course, incumbent governor Scott Walker, a Republican. He's been in office since 2010. Mary Burke is also pretty well known, or she's becoming so. Madison School Board executive at Trek Bicycles, former secretary with Governor Jim Doyle, or Democrat back in up until 2010. We've also got kind of a wild card. Brett Halsey is running as a Democrat, so there will be a primary. And first of all, can he win the primary? And in this kind of a situation, is a primary a good thing for the party and or the populace?
Most people are not taking Brett Halsey seriously. And can he raise the funds to put a challenge up to Mary Burke? That remains doubtful. There isn't much time to raise a lot of money between now and August.
Right.
To begin with. So I don't think it's reasonable to expect that Halsey can compete given the current set of circumstances.
So that said, will that drain, do you think it could be a drain for the campaign coffers in the Burke campaign?
Well, the Burke campaign is simply not paying a lot of attention to him.
Mm.
And they're concentrating on running against Walker. And that race is looking like, and Walker has some primary opposition too, a write-in candidate.
Sure.
That campaign looks like it's going to be very close.
Here's the thing, though. The polls are statistically in a dead heat.
Yes.
But we saw similar polls during the recall with Brett, Mayor Barrett,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. The polls made it seem very close. Then Walker walked away with it.
Sort of walked away with it.
Higher lead than...
Somewhat higher.
Yeah.
Turnout was down from what normally is in a regular primary. That gave Walker some advantages. And then there were some out there who didn't like Walker but felt that the recall wasn't the way to go just because he disagreed with a particular policy.
This second John Doe, I don't really have time to explain it. Do you think this will hurt Governor Walker? I'm asking because we had a John Doe investigation going on during the recall, and that didn't seem to bother him too much.
Burke would have to make a point of it and make it a major point in her campaign. At this stage, one of the most interesting things about that race is that Burke has been subjected to a lot of negative campaigning by outside groups,
right,
including the Republican Governors Association. And despite that, as she gets a little better known, the race gets closer, which tells me that it may be that we're reaching a point where the negative campaigning is counterproductive.
Less than a minute left, Mort. You going to put any predictions out there for the race for governor?
How about a recount?
Okay. There's a safe guess. All right, that's our time. I appreciate it very much, Mort Cypress, for coming in. Emeritus Political Science Professor with UW Eau Claire, Mort Cypress. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Good to be here.
And also thanks to Team Westside, including Jim Oliver for running the phones today, Sadie Horton for helping out, and also Dean Collenbeck and Tiffany Coggins. Tune in next week. We're going to do an agriculture update, get some local farmers on, talk about how the planting season's going. Until then, have a safe and productive week. We'll chat again next Monday morning.